Was Mussolini the first right-wing populist strongman?
He was empty. He had no ideas of his own. He has no strategy of his own. He had no political goals of his own. He had no loyalties to any commitment. And that's why he succeeded. These characteristics makes him not only the founder of fascism, but the inventor of the populist leadership.
That's Antonio Scurati. We talk with him about his international bestseller, M, Son of the Century. Then Tsering Yangtsam Lama tells us about her powerful debut novel of Tibetan exile and resilience, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Benito Mussolini came to power in circumstances that are resonant with the crises we face today. Economic turmoil for the masses, disenchantment with elites that fail to govern, and the erosion of democracy. In his international bestseller, M, Antonio Scurati takes a deep dive into the mind of the dictator and the social conditions he was able to exploit in his rise. By combining fiction with documentary evidence and meticulous historical research, Scurati has invented a new genre, which he calls the documentary novel. M is a cautionary tale that we would all do well to heed. We spoke with Antonio Scurati in May. Antonio Scurati, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, M, Son of the Century, covers the years in Italy from 1919, just post World War I, to 1925, which was when Mussolini became Il Duce, when he became the dictator of Italy. It's the first volume in a series that you plan to take to 1945, and it really centers on what led up to Mussolini's takeover of power in 1925. The book begins with the formation of the Fasci di Combattimento. Who were they? And what led to their formation?
First of all, they were very few. This is the first data we must reflect on. In the first reunion, the day of the foundation of the Fasci di Combattimento, they were less than 100 people. And that's amazing, because if we think that only 3 years later, in 1922, they marched on Rome and they took power. But in March 1919, in their first reunion, they were less than 100 people. And they were almost former soldiers who fought in the trenches of World War I. Most of them, they were soldiers who were not able to go back to a civil life. And so they seek a way to bring war into the everyday life. They longed for war. They were professional of violence. Most of them used to be enlisted in the special forces. In the Italian army, they were called arditi. They were commandos. And Mussolini decided that these people who were able to use violence and were also unable not to do it could be his first followers. But of course, they were not only soldiers. There was also former socialist revolutionary coming from the Socialist Party, like Mussolini himself was. He was a leader of the Socialist Revolutionary Party before the war, and he had been kicked out of the party. And along with him, there were former revolutionaries from Socialist Party, and also some quite famous men like the poet Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, inventor of the Futurism movement, and the great director Arturo Toscanini, which will become in the following years a symbol of anti-fascist. But back in 1919, he used to support the fascist movement.
Yes, you've mentioned Marinetti. You haven't mentioned the poet Gabriele D'Annunzio, but you also go into them in this book. And I guess before we get to Mussolini, since you mentioned violence, it seems very much that violence is almost a kind of non-ideological ideology of this movement. Non-ideological in the sense that in some ways it's not necessarily attached to any particular program. So I wonder if you could explain that threat of violence and then how that is used to bring the fascists to power.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I like this definition, non-ideological ideology. I think it's correct. I didn't mention D'Annunzio because D'Annunzio, he was not a fascist at that time. He was a sort of an idol for fascists. He was someone to look up to. He was much more influential than Mussolini at the time, was the man to whom all nationalists and right-minded Italy look up as a leader for the next Italy. And in the first years, Mussolini tried to swim in the following D'Annunzio. And they talk from D'Annunzio a lot of slogan, words, keywords, ritual. D'Annunzio was the big man at the time. Mussolini was someone who everyone supposed he was doomed to failure in politics. And then in the next years, the things will change. And D'Annunzio will follow the fascism when took power. But going back to the theme of violence, it's crucial. You see, you're right when you say that the first fascists, they had no well-built ideology. They had no political programs. Mussolini used to say that political programs are dull, something to leave to the socialists. The only program they had was action, what they used to say. And of course, violent action. They talked about propaganda of the facts. They used to say, just let's act and things will follow. Ideas will follow. And it was something very seductive for all kind of people unsatisfied, let down from the old political leadership, from the years after war. And the only thing they knew was violence. Hyper-violence they had experienced during 3 or 4 years of war, when the fascist crowd found their legacy and their tie in the experience of violence in the trenches. That's the ground of everything, violence. And violence becomes very, very soon an object of political desire by so many people, even those who are not used to violence. It's not only a matter of efficiency of violence. It's even a matter of symbolic meaning of violence that becomes, as I said, an object of political desire. The people who fear the socialist revolution, who feel the need for a new order, who are resented and deluded and let down by old politics, they start to desire violence as a mythic solution for every problem.
Well, the other connection to fascism of a kind of ideology is nihilism, which I don't know if I have this correct, but it seems that Marinetti and D'Annunzio express a kind of nihilism, and that also seems to be something that comes up today in proto-fascist movements or in neo-fascist movements, actually, that we're having today is a kind of nihilism that there is no truth. You know, there are no facts except the fact of violence, basically, or the fact of action.
Yes, definitely. But you see, this is the hidden truth about fascism. They would not accept a statement like this. They would say, and they used to say, that they would bring the real values, the real commitments against the modernity that had lost the way to values and commitments. But the hidden truth of fascism was the one you said. They were, at the end of the line, they were nihilists. And that's very typical of the Mussolini character as a political leader that I depict in my novel. We are used to think of Mussolini as someone who had very clear and strong ideas about what the new man should be, new Italy should be, new society should be. But that's not true. In the beginning, Mussolini was empty. He had no ideas of his own. He has no strategy of his own. He had no political goals of his own. He had no loyalties to any commitment. And that's why he succeeded. He was a theorician of the supremacy, tactical supremacy of the emptiness. These characteristics makes him not only the founder of fascism, I say, but the archetype, the inventor of the populist leadership. I always say that Mussolini is very actual nowadays, not because he's the founder of fascism, but because he's the first populist leader of history. And this emptiness is the main issues of the populist leader, even nowadays, even if they're not fascist at all, because they are a kind of leader who can lead the crowds by following them, by stepping back, one step back, by hearing and smelling their feeling, their rumors, and repeat their own words.
What you're talking about, of course, brings to mind for an American like myself is Donald Trump, who is absolutely the picture of this. I mean, I'm not sure Mussolini was quite as corrupt, well, certainly morally corrupt, but not a con man in the same way that Donald Trump is. But definitely in those characteristics, the only thing I would push back on is to say that this kind of populism is more of a false populism, not a real populism, not a real movement for the people.
Oh, sure, definitely. A populism is only a name that the man seeking for power gives to himself. And that's the other characteristic that shapes a populist leader. It's the fact that he says, I'm the people. I'm the embodiment of the people. And that's why in the populist leadership, body is so important. The populist leader says, I am the people. In the case of Mussolini, he used to say, I am the Italian people. In the case of Donald Trump, which is a populist leader, and so is a Mussolini scholar, even if he doesn't know about Mussolini. Doesn't matter, okay? They say, I'm the people, I'm the American people, and who's against me is not American. Mussolini used to say that. I'm the Italian people, and whoever is against me is not Italian. Even if he was born in Italy and grew up in Italy, he's not Italian. He is anti-Italian, he's against Italy, and so he can be killed.
Exactly. Now, let's shift for a moment, Antonio Scurati, in this novel, historical novel, M, Son of the Century, you also talk about the socialist movement. You talk about the other political forces that were so powerful at that time. Tell us about socialism as a political force and why it was unable to stop the fascists.
Well, socialism at the time was the great idea of 19th century, was the brightest idea of 19th century. the Romantic century was the idea of that every man could be equal to another man, that women could be and should be equal to males, was the idea of a better future for humankind. The point is that this hope becomes the nightmare for the others. And Mussolini used to be a socialist, a socialist leader, a very radical socialist leader. He used to be part of the wing who wanted the revolution. The problem with socialism was that to achieve the new world, the future, the hope, they needed to make a revolution. And there was half of the humankind who would hope that in that revolution, and the other half would fear it. And so Mussolini was kicked out of the Socialist Party in 1914 because he changed his mind about war. The official statement, position, doctrine about war of the Socialist Party was that the socialists should refuse the war as a capitalist instrument for power. But Mussolini changed his mind about that, and so he was kicked out of the Socialist Party. And after the war, when World War I ended, he had this other insight, and he understood that since he could not bet on hope anymore, the only thing he could do was bet on fear. And he understands that in the new era, in the era of political masses, there was only one political passion more powerful than hope, and that passion was fear. And so he bets everything on fear, and he gains.
But you also really paint a picture of Italy at that time that locates Mussolini in a much broader context of social and political and economic breakdown. Although you speak often in Mussolini's voice, there's an undercurrent in this book, Antonio Scurati, of a blistering critique of the political establishment in those early years of the fascist movement. Neither the socialists who win power nor the liberals are capable of running society. It's kind of a semi-failed state. So could you connect the dots between that social breakdown and the rise of fascism?
Yes, of course. That's one of the reasons why I use so many documents in this book, which is a novel, but as I like to say, is a documentary novel. The readers will find many chapters written by the author, myself, but at the end of every chapter, they will find even original documents, newspaper articles, letters, and so on. Because I think it's unbelievable and also moving to see the blindness of men about their own lives. So many liberal leaders, even very smart and well-cultivated people, some of them were even genius, like the Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce, they did not understand what was going on with fascists. They thought that they would be able to use fascism, violence, and brutality to stop socialism revolution, and then to manage the fascists, these very young and brutal and stupid people, in a sort of tricky old politics, a way to convert them to the parliament combination. And that was just a crazy thing to do, because it was so clear that those brutal young men were the first enemy of a liberal thought. But the liberal leaders, they believed that they would be able to use them and then dump them. And it's incredible and at the same time moving. It's a form of blindness of the man to their own historical life. humankind doesn't understand the historical moment they're living. And I'm afraid that that applies even to our historical moment.
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, I was just thinking to myself yesterday that, you know, the Democratic Party, the leaders of the Democratic Party in the United States, they think that the world that they have been living in all their life is the world that will continue. They believe that the rules, even as they see them being broken all around them, will go on, that they themselves will survive whatever comes because they can't imagine anything different. And as a result, they are not taking seriously enough the threats to democracy that we face now in this country. And I think that your book, Son of the Century, is such an important warning for all of us. You know, one question that has come up, there are those, for example, there's a scholar of fascism in this country, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's at NYU, New York University. She criticized your book as being a kind of part of a rehabilitation of Mussolini, as resurrecting the cult of the leader, she said. And I was surprised to hear that, but I'm curious, what's your response to that critique?
Oh, I don't need to respond to that critique, because Ruth Ben-Ghiat said to New York Times what she said without having read the book. My response is that people should be intellectual, like she is, and a university professor should be more serious than that. And even New York Times should be more serious than that. You know, you first read the book, then you talk. And my response to all people who's listening to us is that despite what Ruth Ben-Ghiat said, this book, this novel, has been, I can say that now because it's been published in Italy more than 3 years ago, and in all Europe and all around the world. It's been published in the US only in the last month, but the book has already gained about 1 million of readers all around the world. And for all of them, reading this book has been an exercise of democracy. It's not me who says that, but the thousands and thousands of letters, posts in internet everywhere. You see, my first concern when I start working at this book and these books was not to rehabilitate Mussolini, not to make out of Mussolini a kind of a romantic hero, tragic hero. And that's why I force myself to this kind of writing, which I call documentary novel. There is no one word, one character, one fact told in this book that it's not historically grounded. And it was a huge effort, the necessity to find a new literary form. And I think that 1 million readers all around the world testify that I was right. Ben-Ghiat should read the book before talk about the book.
You have talked about how the Italian people still see in some way Mussolini as a hero. Talk about how Italians see Mussolini and what does that really mean for how a democracy deals with the authoritarians in its midst.
Yeah, there are a few Italians who still see Mussolini as a hero, but they're not so many. The real problem is that most of the Italians have not yet dealt with the fact that Italy was the cradle of fascism, that Italians had been fascist 100 years ago, even those who are not nostalgic of fascism. And that's why in the late years, anti-fascism was sort of a dogma, but there was a side, a dark side of this question that was removed by the dogma. And this side was that Italian had been fascist, most of the Italians back in the 20s. And one important thing that happened with this book, and is even one of the reasons of the huge success in Italy, and not only in Italy, is that pushed so many people to deal at the end with this historical truth that we were the inventors of fascism, and we Italians 100 years ago were fascists. And this consciousness brought along the awareness that the fight between democracy and totalitarian mind has not ceased. It's not over. That democracy is the fight for democracy. That history is the fight for history, back then and nowadays.
Yeah, that's very powerful to say. And, you know, I was thinking to myself as I read this book, Antonio Scurati, the Red M, that you are almost channeling the voice of Mussolini. Now, I have read that you have used his words, but I thought of how someone who is writing a work of fiction, even if it's, or even more so because it's a work of documentary fiction, you are getting into the mind of this historical character in such an intimate way. And I wondered, what was the impact on you to incorporate this voice within yourself to the extent that you were able to write this voice in so compellingly in this book? What was the emotional impact of kind of channeling Mussolini, a man who was violent, brutal, power hungry? How was that for you?
It had also psychiatric impact, if I must be honest. When I finished writing the book, I didn't feel so well. And so I went to my doctor, and I had some kind of dissociation. And my doctor asked me, what have you been writing in the last years? And I said, a huge novel about Mussolini and fascism. And she looked at me and said, well, you're telling me that you spent the last 3 or 4 years of your life in Mussolini's mind, and you don't want to feel a little dissociated. And so we made fun of it. But as a matter of fact, it was very tough to do. But I think that a fictional writer and novelist always writes in other people's mind, always let the voices of the others to speak through his words. It's something we always do. We must do it. And of course, to do that with an evil character like Mussolini was particularly hard. But I was helped by the fact that I never had any fascination for Mussolini. I was educated into the myth of anti-fascism. And ever since I was a kid and I wanted to be a writer, a novelist, I always dreamt of writing someday a book about partigiani, you know, anti-fascist militants and warriors. And so I could approach Mussolini without any fascination. And that helped me.
And you do write extensively of somebody who is the kind of anti-Mussolini and was anti-Mussolini. In fact, the socialist member of parliament, Giacomo Matteotti, tell us a little bit about him. And was this a kind of curative or corrective psychologically for you to write about him?
Yes, it was. You see, one of the risky choices I made when I decided to write this book that had never been written before was to tell the fascist history through the fascists themselves. Usually in the last 70 years after the end of World War II, the history of fascism was always told under the point of view of the anti-fascism, under the point of view of the victims of fascism, okay? And that it has been a necessary choice, and our democracy are grounded on that kind of narrative. But now that narrative fades down historically, unfortunately. I told to myself that I had to shed light on who the fascists were, which doesn't mean, of course, to agree with them. And so I had to sink myself into the fascist minds and lives. And the only main character of this book was not only about Mussolini, but about many characters of fascist leaders who backed Mussolini in his fight for power. The only character was not a fascist, but was a victim of fascism, is Giacomo Matteotti, the leader of a socialist party. I say one of the socialist party because unfortunately there was more than one. And he was the main victim of fascism because he was kidnapped during the day with the daylight in the center of Rome by fascist killers. And he was kidnapped and killed and assassinated. And they made even a shame of his body. And was the moment in which the fascist regime was about to fall. Because it was 1924 and Mussolini was already running Italy since 2 years. And Matteotti at the time was only straight opposition. He was a very brave and strong, morally strong man who would still stand up in the Congress and speak out against fascism, even if Mussolini was in power. And they decided to kill him. Matteotti became back then and for decades after that a sort of a saint for all anti-fascism. But I wanted to tell the man, not the saint. And so I decided to tell his story using the letters he wrote to his wife, which gives to us a point of view on this man. Brings him down to everyday life. And it's very moving.
It is indeed. And the whole book, I mean, it's very dispassionately written, which I think you're distancing, you approach Mussolini from a distance. That comes through, and I really think it adds to the power of the story because you let the words of the fascists, you let the words of Mussolini speak for themselves, you let the documents speak for themselves, and it really gives the reader a sense of the times that is such a powerful warning for all of us to read. And I want to thank you so much, not just for writing the book, an important book for us in this time, and also for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice.
I thank you, and I hope to be able soon to visit again the United States and to meet you personally. Ciao.
Antonio Scurati. Go to writersvoice.net to read a sample of M, Son of the Century. Next up, a powerful novel of exile, loss, and resilience. Stay tuned after the break. That was the song of the Italian communists, La Bandiera Rossa. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. In today's world, 30 people become refugees every minute, and 68 million people have been displaced, almost certainly an undercount. One of the earliest post-World War II refugee crises happened in 1959, when Mao's People's Liberation Army invaded Tibet. About 80,000 Tibetans, including the Dalai Lama, were uprooted from their ancestral villages and their way of life. Many people died during that exodus. Tsering Yangsom Lama's parents were among those who fled. She was born in Nepal, yet there was much about her family's history that she was unaware of growing up. Her acclaimed debut novel, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies, tells the story of the Tibetan diaspora. But it also brings alive the rich history, traditions, and culture of Tibet. Named a most anticipated book of the year by the Millions and Ms., and among the Washington Post's 10 noteworthy books for May 2022, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies is a story of courage, survival, and resilience by an extraordinary young writer. Tsering Yangsom Lama, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
This is such a beautiful and powerful novel, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies. It's a novel of exile and loss, but also of discovery and resilience. It's about a family that's forced to leave Tibet for Nepal in 1960 when the Chinese invaded. Your family also left then, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. My grandparents were nomads in Western Tibet, and they had to flee. Not everyone fled. Some people remained behind. And my parents were children when they left and began over in refugee camps in Nepal, and I was born there.
Tell us what happened to your family, and tell us, you know, what happened when the Chinese came in.
Well, it was a difficult time to be in Tibet. You know, there were a lot of hardships across the country. In Western Tibet, it happened very differently than in Central or Eastern Tibet. The invasion began in Eastern Tibet from China. And for a lot of Tibetans living there, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama left in 1959, that was a signal that things were going to be hard for a while. And I think when my family left, they left everything behind. I remember my grandmother saying that they had had some yaks, you know, because they love yaks, Tibetans. And there were yaks in the border and they were holding on to them. And but, you know, they had to find food. And so they lent the yaks to somebody. And when they came back, all of them were gone. So literally, they had nothing. And, you know, there was a lot of hardship across Tibet, as I said, with starvation, violence, bombings, and also just a sense that it's really bad right now, but perhaps there will be help down the road. So a lot of Tibetans, including my family, they didn't leave thinking that this would be it. They thought this would be a little while. And as I describe in my novel, there was the sense that we didn't need to build a refugee camp forever. This was just a temporary solution until we could go back. And obviously that hasn't been the case.
Now, you were born in Nepal. You were born in a refugee camp?
I was born in the capital, not in the refugee camp, in Kathmandu.
But your parents were in the refugee camp?
Yes.
For a long time?
Until just about when I was born, so a couple of decades, yes.
Wow. Well, it's all this history is very powerfully outlined in your book, in your novel, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies. Tsering Yangsom Lama, tell us a little bit about some of the main characters in the novel. First, tell us about the sisters Lamo and Tenki.
So Lamo and Tenki are two adolescent sisters growing up in Tibet in the 1950s. Their mother is a village oracle, meaning she guides their village with premonitions and answers from the gods, which is an ancient practice in Tibet. And Lamo and Tenki are just two innocent young girls, and suddenly their lives are turned upside down. First, with their mother's decision to become initiated as an oracle in this time of upheaval and crisis in Tibet and in their village. She wants to guide their village. And then when the mother decides that it's time to leave, that the People's Liberation Army have come to their village and life is becoming increasingly difficult. And she has guidance from the gods and leads their village through the Himalayas, through a very difficult path. And so for Lamo, she's slightly older than Tenki, and she sort of takes on the role of being a caregiver to her little sister who falls ill in the journey. And their parents also suffer a great deal and eventually pass away. And so the two girls end up becoming orphans, and their lives become very, very different. And they also fork apart, because Lhamo is sort of seen as the responsible caretaker for the little sister, Tenki. And Tenki is the chosen one. She's kind of the brilliant hope of the camp. She has all this potential. She's incredibly smart, like her mother was. And the story really follows their journey across 50 years.
You mentioned the oracle. That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because this is really a fascinating tradition I knew nothing about. Talk a little bit about, well, I guess the role of, you even say it, magic in Tibetan tradition, of the tradition of the oracles, and, you know, the system of belief that is so powerful and carries throughout those 50 years.
Right. So the oracular tradition in Tibet is ancient. It actually predates the arrival of Buddhism 1,200 years ago. So it really goes back to indigenous systems of belief and a connection with the land, really. The oracles are vessels for gods that reside in the land, in the lakes, in the mountains, in the earth. And for a lot of Tibet, actually, female village oracles were very important. So male oracles are often in the centers of power in these important monasteries. But for many ordinary Tibetans who live far away from Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, they have female village oracles. And these women, dating back centuries, have guided their villages. And I find that to be a very moving and powerful example of female leadership in Tibet. And when the Chinese invaded, like anything that had to do with traditional Tibetan culture and society, the oracular tradition was also targeted for elimination. So this was something that was threatened. And when Tibetans came into exile, there was an additional pressure for oracles, because now we're living in the West, or now we're living in a non-Tibetan space in which our ways of being, seeing, doing, these don't have a natural place. So even my parents' refugee camp in Nepal had three oracles, which I didn't know about until I was writing this. And my sister was like, oh yeah, I remember seeing these miraculous healings from our neighbor who was an oracle. But, you know, that tradition didn't continue. Like their children aren't oracles. And it's a very difficult thing to survive as a refugee, as a stateless person, and continue on these traditions, which Tibetans have really been very focused on continuing our traditions. But what I mean to say there is that actually the invasion or the dispossession from Tibet isn't just merely about the lens or the conceptual frameworks of nation states, you know, in terms of borders and land. It's also a dispossession of entire ways of being, entire ways of seeing the world, our metaphysics, our civilization. All of these things were also displaced and continue to face existential crisis in Tibet as well. And for me, as somebody who I grew up around like premonitions and stuff, my mother's younger sister is really good at premonitions, but they weren't treated as sort of spectacular things. It was just an everyday thing, you know, where did we leave the cell phone? Let's do a premonition and try to figure it out. Or, you know, will this trip go well? Let's ask someone and find out what they think. But the really deep, rich tradition, that's not something that I had sort of deep connection with, just because I grew up in exile and because I went to American schools and Canadian schools. And so writing this novel for me was a process of really rich study of my culture and my traditions. And I became particularly interested in the oracular tradition, as I said, because of the role of women.
Yes, and it's part of what makes this novel so fascinating. I mean, not only the fact that it's beautifully written and the characters are so compelling, but also that it's a window on a culture that, you know, as you say, is vanishing, and the reader, or at least this reader, really acutely felt the loss of that. I mean, it's a novel of the loss of home and tradition, but it's also the loss of families ripped apart, and so many people who did not survive even the journey from Tibet into Nepal. So talk about the toll on families of this exile.
Mm-hmm. I think a big part of this novel and even the structure, it took me many, many years to find the structure, and it's about relationships. It's, you know, mothers, daughters, sisters, self. And I'm really interested in how families get broken and then remade in exile or as a result of this historical moment. And so for a lot of my characters and actually a lot of people that I know, we call each other sister or aunts or mothers, even if we're not, you know, directly related, but that's the condition of being displaced and living in diaspora. You know, many Tibetans that I know who are from Tibet, like grew up in Tibet, can't see their relatives right now. They can't get visas to enter. And so they have to find ways of reforming family or trying to stay connected to family that they physically can't access. And I think that's also another layer of what is happening to anybody who's displaced. And when I think about Ukrainians, I think about millions of people that are displaced. It's these things are happening on an interpersonal and familial level as well. Every single family is touched by this. And also the strength and the hope and the love between families is really important for me and in this novel. And that comes through new connections, new relationships that are formed as a necessity for survival.
Yeah, and now talk a bit about Semphel or Semphel?
Semphel.
He's a character who in many ways embodies this personal loss. Tell us about him.
Semphel is somebody who, you know, never knew his mother and leaves with his father. And his father also suddenly dies while, you know, in the early days of exile. And he really grows up a complete orphan, all alone. And he forms an early connection with Lamo when he comes to their camp. And that's really at the beginning of the book. But all his life, he's sort of searching for a sense of connection, but he finds it very difficult to do so because of the trauma and the history of loss that he's endured. Semphel is a really interesting character to me because he is sort of an outsider and a misfit. He is engaged in activities that many people would find unsavory in the Tibetan community. I won't say too much exactly about what that is, but you know, he does what he needs to do to survive. And I think he has a very different perspective on sort of morality or what is proper behavior, because, you know, the world hasn't been kind to him and he suffers a great deal because of that. At the same time, he's a character that I really love because no matter what, he tries to do the best he can. He tries to do the right thing insofar as he understands that. And he longs to have connection. He just isn't able to figure out how to do it.
And he's afraid that no one will want to connect with him.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Just because of his history of abandonment and not knowing his mother.
One of the elements in this book is the trade in Tibetan antiquities, which is so interesting, kind of the moral quandary that represents. Talk a little bit about that trade and what you found out about it.
So this has been increasingly a conversation around the world in a lot of different nations, but with the invasion of Tibet, there was a lot of looting in Tibetan monasteries and Tibetan cultural centers. And those materials, some of that was taken by Chinese traders. Some of that was taken by Tibetan traders and disseminated and sold around the world. And you see those objects in museums, in New York, in everywhere, essentially. And I was really interested in that because here's this thing that traveled very freely, these material objects from Tibet. But Tibetan people are essentially trapped in Tibet or very, very rarely are able to escape. Maybe just a few a year nowadays because the borders have become so tightened and security is so difficult. But Tibetan culture and material objects have been adored and celebrated around the world And there's a, in a sense, there's a decoupling from our bodies and our culture. And I wanted to talk about that because this is an extension of colonization. It's an extension of colonialism, that our culture and our objects are celebrated in the West and elsewhere, but there's not as much attention paid to the people that are connected to these objects. And for me, like, and for a lot of Tibetans, when we go to museums, I think there's something quite strange about seeing our religious objects, our gods or deities in this secular space. On the one hand, I'm very happy to see them because at least they're not lost to the ether. On the other hand, these were taken, and also they're religious objects and in this secular space. So in a sense, the context is lost. And really for me, I wanted to stay in that space of, as you said, moral ambiguity. You know, is it okay to take things back when they're taken away from us? Where do these objects belong? Who has a right to say or take? And how is this connected to the much deeper and broader injustice and theft that has taken place in Tibet?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tsering Nyangsom Lama about her novel, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies. I wanted to ask you about one of those objects, the Nameless Saint, because it was through exploring the relationship between this object and the family that is the subject of the book that I understood really the weight of importance of these objects in a very visceral sense for people, you know, and it made me think of the objects I surround myself in my home. You know, they're not religious objects, but they're connected to my family, and that it, absolutely vital connection that is broken. So tell us about the Nameless Lama and his role. And is this even based on a real thing?
It is, actually. This statue is based on a real statue that I saw at the Rubin Museum while writing this novel many years ago. It's part of their permanent collection, but it's not always on display. But it's a very, as I describe in the novel, it's a small statuette about the size of a hand made of mudstone with this very peculiar expression that is not common in the Tibetan Buddhist pantheon of gods and deities and yogis. And this expression really fascinated me because it's not one of like a sort of Buddhist equanimity or peace, or even like a fearsome god of death sort of look that's meant to cut through your ignorance. But it looks like a very pained expression, and also could be an expression of exaltation. And so the enigmatic look of the statue interested me, but also the lack of detail about the statue, where it came from, who took it, how it survived. I knew that it was 500 years old because of the little description at the museum, but I didn't know anything else. And then as I began to study for this book, I really became interested in the treasure text tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, which is called Terma. And these are texts that are either physical texts, or they can be mind termas, like mind texts, that are hidden all across Tibet and are meant to appear and disappear in people's minds to help them, to give them teachings. And I thought there was something really powerful there, because there's this idea in which there's a sort of a epic sort of message that's always available to people if they're willing to listen. And I wanted that to be connected with the statue, because I'm trying to understand the statue and I don't understand it yet. And I don't know the history yet. I don't even know their name. You know, with my characters, I create the same conditions. And yet there is this belief that if we are patient, if we listen, something will come to us. And the statue, like the Terma text, appears and disappears in times of need. So this was my way of exploring both of these topics through a single statue, as you said. Yeah, it's a really important connection that goes beyond just pure worship, but in a sense, this idea that there is this ancient connection that will take care of us in some way.
That's so poignant, because what happens when the gods no longer take care of you, because you know, human beings have intervened in the way of the, you know, the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese, and you know, this terrible destruction. Talk about the tension between forgetting and moving on versus remembering, and both the comforts of remembering and also being kind of driven to madness by remembering.
Yeah, that's a really complicated question, and something that I'm still grappling with, because I think on the one hand, there is this sort of stoicism and this almost kind of Buddhist inclination to not sort of dwell on the past, but to move forward and to try to be better and to do better in the future. And that's coupled with sort of trauma, right? Like with my family, with a lot of Tibetans, you know, speaking of the past is a very difficult thing. It's not something we do regularly. At the same time, I call my book, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies, because we experience these things corporally through our bodies. And there is a sense in which we cannot forget. The effects of colonization, displacement appear everywhere all the time. And so this tension between a desire to move forward and not to look in the past, but this recognition that actually we can't ever completely forget, is throughout the novel. And it's not something that I've completely worked out for myself, but I do believe in the power of human expression and the importance of writing stories and speaking stories. And so I wanted to pay attention and recognize this essential tension in all of my characters' experiences.
Yeah, and that title, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies, there's another meaning as well.
Yes. So another ancient tradition in Tibet is a pilgrimage through prostrations. So this is where the pilgrim will fold their hands in prayers, raise it up to the sky, lie down on the ground, face down, put a dent in the earth with their fingertips, get up and step to that dent and repeat that process. So it's a very slow, methodical, meditative way of moving across a space. Sometimes they will circle a holy site like Mount Kailash or a stupa. And sometimes they'll travel from one place to another holy site. And, you know, this is something that Tibetans can't necessarily do all the time in Tibet right now, because movement is very restricted. Certainly for me as a Tibetan exile, I can't access Tibet. But also, I wanted to talk about how this is the slow movement of Tibetans and refugees really across the world. We move with our bodies. We feel these things in our bodies. This is a deeply, deeply felt experience. This is not just a theoretical or romantic notion of exile and what it means to be a refugee and survive and come out on the other side much better, but actually day to day, the quotidian sort of existence of ordinary Tibetans is one that is felt in the body. And so I wanted to, you know, wrap up all of that together, thinking about how much the land matters to Tibetans. As I said earlier, it's not something that can just be understood through, you know, the headlines, but the land is, it contains all of these meanings and rituals. And at the same time, when we're shut off from the land because of these colonial borders, really, then we have to move across the earth. And that is another form of prayer.
Well, that's so beautiful. Now, in writing this book, I have the impression that you uncovered much that you hadn't known about your own culture and tradition. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. You know, on the one hand, there's a long, long tradition of non-Tibetans writing about Tibet. It goes back centuries, you know, whether it's Christian missionaries or our current colonizers. There are a lot of stories told about Tibet by Chinese people that are full of racist depictions. And I wanted to respond to that. But really, more importantly, it was for me a way to spend time understanding these characters who experienced something I didn't experience. You know, I was born in Nepal. I've lived in the West. And when I think back to just like two generations ago, my grandparents were nomads and my parents were refugees. It's staggering to me, this kind of upheaval and, you know, transformation that could have really been fatal for our people. Yet we have survived, and I wanted to understand, what did these folks go through? And that became the subject of my book, and honestly, it's the subject of my life too. And as I researched it, I became more and more fascinated with all of these aspects. As I mentioned, the oracular tradition, the Terma texts, the antiquities trade, and Tibetan art in general is fascinating. And there's so much richness and a culture that really I have been cut off from because of history. And I like to think of this book as a way of building a bridge back to the things that history have denied me. And really, I wanted to take my reader there too, deep into the consciousness of these characters, but also to Tibet, which is not something that many people can go and do.
I think you succeeded phenomenally. This is a book that will stay with me for a long time, because it's not just about themes that are universal, of loss and deracination, but also the particularity, the richness of this culture that just opened a window to me that I'm so grateful to you for, Tsering Yangtsam Lama.
Thank you.
This is such a wonderful book, We Measure the Earth with Our Bodies. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca. I really appreciate this.
Tsering Yangtsam Lama was born and raised in Nepal and has since lived in Canada and the U.S. She's a co-founder of Lakar Diaries, a leading English-language blog among Tibetan youth in exile, and is a contributor to many prestigious literary venues. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.